Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to a Weeby Geeks Network podcast.
This is why people want to hear about Disney and fall in love with Disney. It's the real world is too real. You need to go to the fantasy world where everybody is treated like a VIP and everything is taken care of and you feel safe and you feel loved and you know there's always. Some new surprise, you know, so...
And we're all just happy little princesses.
That's about it.
Welcome.
What is this place?
Never, never land.
We're going to bring ghosts from all over the world.
Join us.
The children are screaming.
And we guarantee them creaking doors and creaking floors.
Be sure to bring your death certificate.
Take your pixie out of your pockets, Neverlanders. Sprinkle some of that pixie dust around. Think your happiest thought, and let's fly away to Neverland. It's bound to be a little bit spooky, though, this week. I'll tell you why here in just a little bit. I, of course, am the head lost boy around here, Jeremy, but you can call me Spider-Pan, because that's what they call me amongst the lost boys. You can get a nickname as well at neverlandpodcast.com if you decide you just want to join the Neverlanders. It's all in fun. I don't record any of your data. I just basically share what you share with me to everybody out there to let everybody know that we have a new Neverlander, which you could be a lost boy or a pixie. We don't have lost girls around here because girls are too clever. They don't get lost. We have something special, though, this week, because we're going to, for the next couple of weeks, we're going to hear from Jim Corcus about some of the making of Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas. This is a movie that it didn't really start out as the hit that it has become. It wasn't a huge success, but it has grown quite the following, and basically we're all fans of it. In fact, it took me a while, I know, though. Before I was a fan, I had to watch it a few times before it really became something I really enjoyed. Because when I first watched it, it's like watching a series of music videos. And you can tell that the script was written after the songs, the way it's presented. There were good songs, but it seemed like it was lacking story. And the character I thought I was supposed to be rooting for, really, he's ruining my favorite holiday, Christmas. But when you start to kind of realize that Sally is the hero and you get behind Sally's story, that's what kind of got it for me. I'm like, see, Sally is our hero. She's the one that's really going to save Christmas. And after Jack realizes what he's done, he goes and he does set it right. And he's still likable characters. But it's just a weird, quirky movie, The Nightmare Before Christmas. And for the next 2 weeks, we're going to talk with Jim Corcus about this movie. So strap in. Carve your jack-o'-lantern, sit back, and enjoy my conversation with Jim Corcus.
To Disney and beyond.
Hey, Neverlanders. We have another returning guest. This is going to be fun, because it always is, and I always learn a whole lot. He's not quite a Disney legend, but maybe he should be. He knows pretty much everything anyway, right? So we were brought on to us Disney historian, Disney author, Jim Quarkus. Hello again.
Hey, and thanks for that great introduction, but I will tell you that I know enough that I know how much I don't know. and again, one of the exciting things and frustrating things at the same time about Disney history is there are new things that are being discovered every single day, you know, and this is just about history. It's not about, you know, even Disney as it is today, because I tell people Disney today, its middle name is Jell-O, because things are in constant flux. Sometimes they'll announce something and never follow through on that, or sometimes something will pop up as a surprise, or sometimes things will disappear without any notice whatsoever. Yeah, my gosh, the more I know, I have come to realize there's so much more that I don't know. And the frustrating thing is that I wish I had known some of these things when some of these people like Ward Kimball and Mark Davis and all of that were alive, where I could have asked them some of these questions. But at the time that I got a chance to interview them, I didn't know some of these things that they had done. And so other people didn't either. So we lost that opportunity. So I'm glad for podcasts like yours where we can get this information out there and share that with people, because Disney is very bad at documenting things. Because they're so involved in getting things done and then getting on to the next thing that it never occurs to them that, you know, boy, we should write down what we were doing and why we made these decisions and who was involved and all of this, because maybe somebody's going to be interested in that, you know. And even as those of us who visit Disney theme parks and all that, you know, we all just take it for granted, you know, that, oh, that's there, that'll be there. And the next time we're there, you know, where is that? Where did that go? You know, the Muppets in Liberty Square in Magic Kingdom just ended October 5th and nobody knew. You know, wait, you were going to end that show? The Mickey's of Hollywood store in Disney's Hollywood Studio just reopened after a rehab, and all of the Mickey figures that were in there for Steamboat Willie and for the band leader Mickey and for Sorcerer Mickey, all of those are gone now. So that you know, people can just see more merchandise. But, you know, that'll always be there.
They've even recently changed the names of the foods in Star Wars Galaxy's Edge from having Star Wars names to being now it's just roast beef. You know, what? Wait a minute. This used to be a roast alien, you know.
Yeah, that's it, you know. So it's important to write these things down. It's important to save those guide maps. And you better save those guide maps, because some of my sources are telling me that Disney's going to get rid of those, you know, because of the cost of, printing and updating and all of that, that they'll just go where, again, you'll just have to have an app on your phone that'll have the map, you know.
Oh, but it's such a great souvenir.
I like having something physical in my hands. I like having a physical map, even though they've reconfigured them now so that, you know, wait a minute, is this the top or is this the bottom? What have they done here? But, you know, it all comes down to money.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to, well, the guests won't miss that. Yes, they will. I'm still missing the Golden Horseshoe Review show, you know?
Yeah.
I still grumble about that, but, you know, but, you know, we talk about the parks, you know, sometimes we forget the Disney is a film company and they've produced, you know, some important films and memorable films, you know, over the year. And as we you know, come to the Halloween season, you know, there are certain films that stick out, of course, like Hocus Pocus, which didn't really do well when it was first released. And of course, today we're going to be talking about The Nightmare Before Christmas. And you don't realize that films like that, Hocus Pocus and Nightmare Before Christmas, is very, very courageous on the part of the Disney company.
Yeah.
And why is it courageous? Because many countries around the world do not celebrate Halloween or do not celebrate it the way that we do in the United States. Today, as a film company, you have to be pay attention to, you know, how is this going to work in a market like China or France or yeah. wherever, you know? And here's all of these customs and traditions that we Americans just take for granted, and they're as strange to other countries as it would be if somebody said, "Oh yeah, there's a great new film coming out, and it's going to be celebrating Guy Fawkes Day." What? What the heck is that all about?
Yeah,
you know.
And it's even a risk because of what everybody expects from Disney is, you know, when you look at like past films where they, you know, Return to Oz, which mm-hmm. was, you know, dark and weird. And then two films I was hoping Disney Plus was going to have, but I didn't see them on the list on the announcements this week. But I would like to see The Watcher in the Woods and Something Wicked This Way Comes, mm-hmm. which were two risks to put the Disney label on, which is why The Nightmare Before Christmas, like, let's put that out at Touchstone and let's just see what happens. And
although today it is considered officially a Disney Pictures film. There are only two yep. Touchstone films that were then retrofitted to be part of the official Disney film legacy. And so Nightmare Before Christmas was one. The other, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Only two Touchstone films. And again, both of them were released under Touchstone because, as you were saying, this is subject matter or even just the attitude is something that we don't want, you know, really reflecting, you know, Disney. This is not part of the Disney brand.
Yeah.
But again, they became so popular and so beloved that they are now officially considered Disney films. Whereas another Touchstone film, Dick Tracy, is still a Touchstone film. It's not considered an official Disney film.
Somehow or another, I can still see Walt up in whatever theater he was, where he's famously, after seeing, Citizen Kane, and he cussed and say, "They wouldn't let me make that kind of film."
No, well, and again, he told his son-in-law, Ron Miller, that, you know, Walt had a screening room at his house, at his home. One night, he screened for Ron and his wife, Diane Disney Miller, Mockingbird, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird film. And at the end of it, Ron told me that Walt looked at him and he said, "I wish we could make films like that." But he knew that at that particular time, an audience had certain expectations of a Disney film and wouldn't accept that. Now I think the expectations are a little broader, and I think the fact too that there is the Marvel film, the Marvel mm-hmm. Cinema Universe, and the Star Wars universe, and those are tied to Disney, but you know those really wouldn't be considered part of the Disney brand back in the 60s and all of that.
Yeah.
You know, because there are certain attitudes, there's certain content that wouldn't be acceptable today. It's a little broader, but still the bottom line is when you see the name Disney, you're expecting to see, you know, a family film. And so
yeah.
That's one of the reasons why Nightmare Before Christmas was so odd. But we were talking about Ron Miller. It is thanks to Ron Miller that we got films like that because at the Disney Studios, he said, we've got to reinvent Disney. And so he brought in people like Tim Burton, you know, who thought differently, you know.
Boy, does he ever think different.
Well, in fact, they brought him in, and the first film they put him on was Fox and Hound, and they teamed him with Glenn Keane. And Burton admits, he says, I just could not draw cute Disney foxes. Mine look like roadkill. And so they ended up giving him sort of the distant shots, you know, of the characters. And then the cleanup artist would go in and touch things up. And then they assigned him to be concept art with Andreas Deja for The Black Cauldron. And you would think, oh my gosh, this is going to be perfect for Tim Burton, you know, this yeah. sort of dark film and all this. And so for a year, he literally sat in a room, you know, doing this. And the reason they teamed him with Andreas Deja was so that they were hoping that Deja could go and take what Burton was drawing and make it more into that Disney style, you know, that circular type style and all that, so it could be usable. But Burton said, you know, my gosh, after a year of sitting in the room drawing whatever I wanted, all of this weird stuff, I realized they're not going to use any of it. And they didn't. they didn't even adapt any of that stuff. And so there's a great book that Disney Editions could be putting out, which is all of the unused concept art for Black Cauldron done by Tim Burton. But fortunately, there were people at the studio who saw, you know, this guy has a talent. We're just not tapping into it. And so he was given a chance to make a little 7-minute stop-motion short called Vincent, which is the story of a boy who wants to grow up to be Vincent Price.
Yeah.
And Burton was in heaven because of the Disney name. They were actually able to get Vincent Price to come in and narrate it.
Yeah.
And but again, it's out of the ordinary as a Disney short. It's very gothic. It's very, very gloomy, very emo, you know. And in fact, people at Disney came in and said, well, can we change the ending so that the we only see the mother. So at the end, could we have the father come in and take his son out, you know, to a baseball game, and so suddenly he becomes brighter and happier, and Burton was just appalled at that as an option, and so it wasn't changed, and it did well on the you know, independent film circuit and the film festival circuit and all of that, but again, Disney, you know, just didn't know what to do with it. But or with the later live action film he did, Frankenweenie, you know.
Yeah.
But at the time he was working on Vincent, he also wrote, because Vincent is done as a rhyming poem. You know, sort of like he was trying to do a thing of Edgar Allan Poe meets Dr. Seuss type thing.
Yeah.
And so at the same time, he wrote another poem, a 3-page poem, and it featured Jack Skellington, and it featured his dog, you know, his ghost dog Zero, that has that little glowing orange jack-o'-lantern as a nose, which I don't think many people immediately recognize, but once somebody tells you that, you take a look and you go, oh my gosh, look at that nose there. And mm-hmm. Santa Claus, so it's only 3 characters, and you know, it's a takeoff on The Night Before Christmas, because Burton, of course, grew up in Burbank, California. I grew up in Glendale, which was adjacent to Burbank, so I know what he was talking about. You know, in Southern California there, you really only have 2 seasons, you know, brown and browner. That's about it, you know. And so for Tim Burton, the way he recognized when there was a new season is the decorations, you know, that appear in the stores. You know, you've got the Halloween decorations and all of that. And especially since you're in the Burbank area, which is near, you know, TV studios and film studios and all that, you have these people who are doing up, you know, these elaborate displays, you know, and elaborate haunted houses, you know, for kids to go through and all of that. I participated in a couple of them. They're just, you know, holy cow. They're hard to describe. But what Burton also saw was that the top selling season, of course, is Christmas. That's when most retailers, make their money. That's when most books are sold. You know, it's because people are either buying books for themselves as a gift or they're buying them to give as a gift. So I'm going to remind your listeners, you know, we're coming into the holiday season here now. Go to Amazon.com and look for Jim Corcus, and I've got a brand new book coming out next week, Vault of Walt, Volume 8, which is all about outer space stories, all the outer space stories that were in TV shows like the Ward Kimball things and films like Black Hole and Treasure Planet and comic books and all of that type of stuff. And so make my Christmas very merry and do that. So anyway, Burton is seeing that the Christmas season is where people are making their money. And so they keep extending, you know, the Christmas season, you know. And so suddenly it's encroaching on Halloween. You know, you're skipping Thanksgiving entirely and going right from Halloween to Christmas. And so in Burton's mind, Halloween and Christmas just seem to be in the same, you know, witch's cauldron, you know, steaming there together. And then also at Christmas, Burton was of that age, you know, he was born in 58. So, you know, he was just a young kid when a lot of the Christmas specials popped up on TV, like How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and especially all those Rankin-Bass stop-motion half-hour specials, like Rudolph and all of that, you know, the Heat Miser and Cold Miser and all of that. So that's all just stirring in his head when he comes up with this. And so, you know, he takes it to Disney, and Disney basically says, what are we going to do with this? You know? Burton teamed up with a couple of friends, Henry Selick, who, you know, later directed Nightmare Before Christmas, and Rick Heinrichs, who did an awful lot of the design work and design work for a lot of his later live-action films, and they went to different networks to try and pitch it as a half-hour Christmas special or Halloween special. You know, either one, whatever one you want to buy, this is it, you know. And they got, you know, no interest. You know, they even tried to pitch it as a feature film that would have been hand-drawn animated, you know. But again, you know, Burton says, everybody kept looking at me like that odd relative that they let out of the attic, you know, for the holidays, and then push them back in and don't want to talk about for the rest of the year. And around this same time, so we're talking about 84 right now, 1984, Michael Eisner comes in. And so when he comes in, and especially with Katzenberg, it's their cleaning house. You know, Ron Miller had kept some of these people on, you know, in the hopes that they would, you know, produce something different, you know. And one of the people Ron Miller brought on was Brad Bird, you know, who later went on to do The Incredibles and Family Dog and so many of these other things. But he was let go too, you know. Basically, Eisner and all, you know, just cleaned house. And a lot of people don't realize this, but Eisner was going to just eliminate the entire animation department. Because he says, you know, we've got enough animated films, we can just keep re-releasing them, you know. And it's too expensive, it's too time-consuming to do these. But the person who helped put Eisner in place was Roy E. Disney.
Of course.
And Eisner, you know, basically went to him and he said, okay, you know, it's time for payback now. What do you want, you know, in exchange for, you know, making sure I got this job? And Roy E. Disney said, give me the animation department. And Eisner was ecstatic. Because if he gave Disney the animation department and it fell apart, as everybody was predicting it would be at the hands of a Disney. And Eisner's hands would be clean. And unfortunately, this happened after Burton had been let go. Because Roy E. was like Ron, you know, let's bring in these, you know, outcasts, you know, because they're the ones who can give us something, you know, new. And Roy supported an awful lot of, out there projects. And, you know, that's the reason Destino, the Salvador Dali project finally got done. That was from Roy Disney. The fact that Leslie Iwerks was able to do a book and a documentary on her grandfather of Iwerks was because Roy said, open up the archives so she can have whatever she wants, you know, to do that. But poor old Tim Burton is out in the California cold at this particular point. And Paul Rubens.
Well, thank goodness for Warner Brothers, I guess.
Well, Paul Rubens wanted to do a film, a feature film, mm-hmm. about his character, Pee-wee Herman, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And he was looking around and he wanted to find, you know, just the right director who had that same sort of slanted sensibility and all of that. And Shelley Duvall, who is an actress who had been in Burton's Frankenweenie.
Oh, yeah, she was.
This is how things work in Hollywood. It's all these connections and schmoozing at parties and all that. She told Ruben, you should take a look at Frankenweenie. I think this guy is what you're looking for. And Rubens looked at it, and to seal the deal, Stephen King had seen Frankenweenie and loved it.
Oh, cool.
And had also mentioned, you know, Burton to Rubens. And so, you know, Burton had never directed, you know, a feature film, for crying out loud. He had done a short, and in fact he had done a short at a live action short at Disney on Hansel and Gretel that was so bad. How bad was it, Jim? It was so bad it was only shown once on Halloween night on the Disney Channel and never ever shown again. A couple of years ago, a version was slapped together and run at a couple of Tim Burton film retrospectives. But yeah, it is so bad. And I've watched it, and you know, you can see the design work is obviously, you know, Tim Burton, but it is just so slow, and he really doesn't get anything out of his actors. Frankenweenie, I love. I love. But if Rubens had seen Hansel and Gretel, you know, well, too bad for that. But anyway, so Burton was brought in, and he did, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, 1985. Remember, 84, he's let go. 1985, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, huge yeah. hit. And he follows that with Beetlejuice in 88 and Batman, Tim Burton's Batman in 89 and Edward Scissorhands in 1990. This is four hits in a row, for crying out loud. And in the case of Batman, you know, it just spawns that whole merchandising franchise and all of this. And so Jeffrey Katzenberg is over at Disney just licking his lips, you know.
Yeah.
This is what we want. You know, Katzenberg was hoping that Dick Tracy was going to take off like Batman, you know, because you have those grotesque villains, you know, you have that stalwart hero, that, you know, this comes from a long-running comic, you know. But what Katzenberg didn't take into account was nobody knew Dick Tracy. You know, nobody was reading.
I did. I always read the Sunday Funnies.
And Dick Tracy was still appearing in the Sunday Funnies, but, you know, nobody was paying attention. And so, you know, Burton now is successful. And again, you know, as you were saying, these are all Warner Brothers films. And Burton wants to break away from Warner Brothers because it's not good to have keep all of your eggs in the same basket, right?
Yeah.
You wanted work for, you know, other studios, you know, so a safety net, you know, because what if Warner Brothers goes belly up? You know, a lot of studios were on the verge, you know, of that happening. Some of them already had. All it took was just one bad film, and the whole studio was out of business because they're doing all these blockbusters. Burton decided he wanted to do something personal. So what he did was he had his lawyer, more or less, talk to Disney. Actually, it wasn't his lawyer, it was his agent. Talked to Disney and go, you know, is it possible I might be able to buy back, you know, that three-page poem, you know, I did, and there were some sketches, and Rick Heinrichs had actually made up a model of the character to use, you know, in those pitch meetings that they were doing. And some studios will sell back things because that'll, you know, recoup the amount of investment they put in that. But as soon as, you know, Burton asked, you know, all the sirens go off, you know. Tim Burton is interested in this, you know. Go down to the morgue, find what's down there, you know. You know, what is it we've got? You know, we found gold, and so Katzenberg also wanted to corner the market in animation. You know, he didn't want anybody else to have a successful animated film, you know, and
I'm sure was making him nervous.
Yeah, well, what had happened is, you know, American Tail had come out and had done well.
Yes.
And it's like, no, the only Disney features that should be out there should be coming, you know, from Disney. And so Katzenberg thought, let's see if we can work out an arrangement with Burton. We won't sell him back the thing, but maybe he'll do it for us, you know. And in fact, that's how Disney operates all the time. It, you know, they went to George Lucas and said, gee, you know, why don't you do a theme park attraction? And if you're happy with that, why don't you do a couple of films for us? You know, and the same thing with James Cameron and Avatar. And, you know, as long as we're talking Halloween, it was the same thing with Mel Brooks. You know, the first choice for Disney Hollywood Studios was not Tower of Terror.
Right.
Eisner had gone to Mel Brooks and said, would you like to do, you know, an attraction, you know, for us? We wanted to do a scary attraction, and you did Young Frankenstein. And so Mel Brooks got involved, and he was going to do Castle Young Frankenstein. at the Disney Hollywood Studios. And then that developed into Mel Brooks' Hollywood Horror Hotel, where you would be in these golf carts, which, again, are used in the back lots of studios, and yeah. There'd be that magnetic strip, you know, on the ground, and you'd be going through, you know, this hotel. So you'd where Mel Brooks is filming a horror film. And so you go through the kitchen, and there's witches, you know, in a cauldron, and there are things coming out of the cauldron, and you meet Quasimodo because he's the bell boy of the hotel, and you even go into the men's bathroom where you see Dracula trying to shave in a mirror, but you can't see his reflection, and the Wolfman is combing all the hair on his entire body, and there's Frankenstein in a bathroom stall. And he's reaching underneath the stall because in the stall next to him is the mummy, and Frankenstein has run out of toilet paper. and so one of the reasons Eisner had approached Brooks to do this is because he felt, okay, if we get him involved with this, then he'll be doing films for us. Yeah. So that was the Disney way. So Katzenberg's way was, okay, let's get Burton, because, my gosh, he just had four hits in a row, for crying out loud, you know? Who has that, you know? And even if this is the worst film in the world, you know, it'll be a Tim Burton film. We'll make enough money the first weekend, it'll cover everything, you know? And in fact, Katzenberg insisted that the title, the official title, is Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Right.
And that is extremely odd to have, you know, the filmmaker's name as part of the title. You know, I don't know if any of your listeners can even pull up, you know, half a dozen that over decades that have been done that way. Now, Burton goes, okay, you know, I'll do this, but it has to be done my way. And, you know, Katzenberg at that particular time is, we don't care. We're already going to be successful, you know, because it's Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas. That's already the audience. Because Burton at that time was already committed to making the sequel to Batman, Batman Returns. Yeah. So he's already in pre-production for that. And, you know, he also feels that, you know, Disney just doesn't have the talent pool that can make this. So he sets up a studio in San Francisco, which is where Henry Selick lived and did some work. But they also set it up in San Francisco, so it's far enough away from the Disney studios that the Disney executives are not there every day looking over people's shoulders and going, well, maybe the character should be smiling more. Maybe, you know, it's far enough away that he's got some isolation, and he wants to make it in stop-motion puppet animation, mm-hmm. you know, rather than as an animated hand-drawn animated film. And one of the reasons for that is because of his affection for those Rankin-Bass holiday specials, and also the fact that he feels that a three-dimensional figure just seems more real.
Yeah.
And that when you have somebody in there, you know, with their own hands, you know, moving this and all this, it gives it a greater sense of life, because he grew up, you know, with the King Kong and the Ray Harryhausen films and all that. And one of the great things about King Kong is one of the things that makes King Kong look so alive is that his fur rustles, you know, mm-hmm. randomly. And the reason for that is when the animator went in with his fingers, you know, to adjust Kong, they were depressing the rabbit fur. So so you're taking a shot, so there's that. But on the next shot, it's back out. And so these things are moving like a real animal. But there was a complete accident of that happening. But anyway, he wants to do this in as three-dimensional animation here. And, of course, Disney goes, yeah, you know, go do this, whatever you want. You know, we'll have a Tim Burton film, you know, and this will also make Disney seem cool, you know. Now, the problem is there's that three-page poem that has just three characters in it.
Yeah.
There is no script. There is no script, and filming has to get started. So Burton has worked with Danny Elfman, magnificent composer. And a lot of people don't realize that Elfman composed the theme song for The Simpsons. That's Danny Elfman. But he's done so much, and of course he had done the music for all of Burton's
films. Pee-wee's Big Adventures and Beetlejuice and Batman.
Yeah, that's it.
Edward Not to mention, you know, Weird Science. We can credit him with that.
And so he gets together with Danny Elfman, and what they do is they write the songs first.
Yep.
They sit down, and Burton is explaining the scenes and what goes on, and then Elfman says, "Get out of my house." And he sits down and writes a song, and then pulls Burton back and listen to this, you know. And Elfman would then play it for his six-year-old daughter Molly before he even showed it to anybody, and if Molly could then, you know, hum back the melody, he knew he had something. And Elfman said, you know, he told Disney this is not going to be like, you know, Beauty and the Beast and all that, where you have that, you know, breakout song that's going to be on the pop charts and things like that. These songs are used to, you know, reveal the character or forward along the plot. And in fact, he's using as his guide Gilbert and Sullivan and Kurt Weill, who did Threepenny Opera. And not Broadway musicals or anything like this. And so he's putting together, you know, the songs, you know, before the whole story script actually gets written. And in fact, the very first thing that was animated is the song What's This? You know, because the animators can't wait, you know, for the full script, you know, they've got to start animating because you can only get sometimes 1 minute of animation a week.
Yeah.
Because, you've got this figure and then you move it and then you take the picture and then you move it a little bit and you take it and move it again and take it a little and move it. And sometimes there's dozens of characters in the scene that have to be moved. And also they have what is called face replacement.
Yeah.
So like Jack Skellington had almost 100 different faces. So you see the start of the smile, and then the smile gets a little bigger and a little bigger, and there's the smile, and then it's got to go back, you know, and so you're doing all of that. And so they build these massive sets, and they're up on a platform because sometimes the puppeteers had to crawl underneath the set and then just pop up, you know, in the scene to move that figure and then pop back down. And they had people behind the sets doing this and all this. And the sets, they've covered with clay and then carved into them. So not only do they look three-dimensional, you get that sort of cross-hatching that, effect that you usually get, you know, in a Tim Burton drawing.
Thank you for listening to the Neverland Podcast.
We invite you back next week for more fun and adventure.
Until then, remember to keep a pixie in your pocket.
It's that young at heart, positive attitude that you can share with others.
And remember to visit our website at neverlandpodcast.com.
There you can find links to our news page, our shop,
our contact page, where you can easily send an email to podcast@neverlandpodcast.com.
You can also find our Neverlanders page, where you can find out how to become an official Lost Boy or Pixie, because girls are too clever to get lost.
Become a real Neverlander.
Please feel free to leave us a voicemail at 816-226-6492.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NeverlandPCast.
And like our Neverland Podcast fan page on Facebook.
We also have a group on Facebook for you to join.
We also appreciate your support to keep the Neverland Podcast up and running.
Visit patreon.com/neverlandpodcast to donate to keeping the pixie dust alive.
Copyright content featured on the Neverland Podcast is copyright of their respective creators and used under fair use license.
All original content is copyright of Blue Band Productions, and a very special thanks to Yeehaw Bob Jackson at yeehawbob.com for our new ending music.
God bless!
Yeah! Hello, everybody, this is Yeehaw Bob Jackson. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Neverland Podcast, it's true. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Yay!
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.